A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel was in a parking lot downtown earlier this week, and the ground was shaking. Not a tremor. We get enough of those that you learn the difference. But this deep, rhythmic thumping you could feel in your teeth. Hammering for foundation excavation. The kind that's become basically the background noise of Jerusalem lately. And he got to thinking, when a contractor decides mechanical hammering isn't going to cut it, and they need to actually blast through rock, who do they call? And in a country where military engineering has been woven into statehood since day one, how much of that expertise bleeds into the civilian world, and how much is deliberately kept separate?
It's such a good question, because we walk past these sites every day and see the cranes and the heavy machinery, but the moment explosives enter the picture, our brains just default to army. Which makes sense. That's the cultural association. But there's this whole parallel universe of civilian professionals whose entire job is to make things explode in exactly the right way, at exactly the right millisecond, so that a 20-story tower can go up without cracking the 200-year-old synagogue next door.
That's the counterintuitive part. We talked in a previous episode about how controlled blasting can be safer than days of mechanical hammering. The vibration from hammering accumulates. It fatigues materials. It's this slow grind that stresses structures over time. A properly designed blast delivers all the energy in a couple of seconds, and then it's done. So the safe option is sometimes the one that sounds terrifying.
Right, and that paradox. The thing that feels more dangerous being the safer choice. That's the doorway into this whole profession. Because it's not just push button, rock go boom. The person who designs that blast is doing math that accounts for the geology, the proximity to existing structures, the delay timing between individual charges, the direction they want the energy to travel. It's genuinely an engineering discipline.
That's what we're going to dig into. Who these people are, what they're actually called, how you become one, and how the whole system of regulating civilian explosives works in Israel, where the line between military and civilian expertise is maybe thinner than in most places. Daniel laid out three specific things he wants to know. One, who a contractor calls when the excavation plan says, we're going to need explosives. Two, how the hazardous materials are regulated day to day. And three, what these professionals are actually called. Because guy who blows things up probably isn't on the business card.
It is not. Although I would absolutely hire someone with that business card. I'm just saying.
Where do we even start? Because I think for most people, myself included, until I started looking into it, the mental model is just explosives equals military, equals classified, equals we don't ask questions. But there's a whole civilian licensing apparatus that's been operating since the 1950s.
Since exactly 1954. The Explosives Law of 1954 is still the governing framework. And what's fascinating is that the licensing authority for civilian blasters in Israel isn't some construction ministry or interior ministry. It's the Ministry of Defense, specifically the Licensing Division for Explosives and Security Materials. So there is this institutional overlap baked into the system from the very beginning, even though the profession itself is entirely civilian.
Which is already interesting, because that's not how most countries do it. In the United States, civilian blasters are licensed by the ATF under the Department of Justice, a law enforcement framework. Here, it sits under defense. And I think that tells you something about the Israeli approach to anything that goes boom.
It absolutely does. And it also creates this interesting tension where the Ministry of Defense is regulating something that has nothing to do with defense. It's about building apartment towers and light rail tunnels, but the institutional culture and the security mindset are inseparable from how the system operates. The security clearance process for a civilian blaster is not trivial.
Before we go deeper into the regulatory stuff, I want to sit with the actual moment Daniel described. Jerusalem is transforming in a way that makes this visible, literally visible and audible, to every resident. You can't walk 10 minutes in the city center without passing an excavation bit. The light rail expansion, the new high-rises near the entrance to the city, the underground parking structures. All of this requires going through limestone and dolomite that doesn't cooperate with a shovel.
Jerusalem sits on karstic limestone. It's fractured, it's unpredictable, and in some places it's extremely hard. Mechanical hammers can do a lot, but there are points where the rock just laughs at them. And that's when the contractor picks up the phone.
Let's actually answer the first part of Daniel's question. Who picks up the phone? What is this person called?
In Hebrew, the profession is called a mefatzetz, a blaster. In English, you'll see blaster or explosives engineer, or sometimes drilling and blasting engineer. The formal title depends on the context, but blaster is the licensed professional designation. And I want to emphasize, this is a licensed profession. You cannot just be someone who knows about explosives and offer your services. You have to hold a specific license issued by that Ministry of Defense division, and the license is tiered. There's a basic blasting license covering most construction and quarry work. Then there are endorsements or separate tiers for underwater blasting, seismic blasting, demolition blasting. Each requires additional training and certification. The person who can blast a highway cutting through the Galilee is not automatically qualified to blast underwater for a port expansion in Haifa.
That makes sense, but it also raises the question of how you get any of these licenses in the first place. What's the pipeline?
Three main requirements: written exam, practical field test, and security clearance. The written exam covers blast theory, powder factor, which is the ratio of explosive weight to rock volume, burden and spacing calculations, delay timing. The practical test is supervised blasting on a real site, where you have to demonstrate that you can design and execute a blast pattern safely. And then the security clearance, which is the bottleneck.
The security clearance being the bottleneck is not something I would have guessed, but it makes sense given the Ministry of Defense's involvement. What are they actually screening for?
Criminal background, obviously, but also associations and affiliations that would raise security concerns. Remember, this is someone who will have access to commercial explosives, detonators, and the knowledge to use them. In Israel, that's treated as a national security matter, not just a workplace safety matter. The clearance process can take months, and that's one of the reasons there's actually a blaster shortage right now.
A blaster shortage? That's not a phrase I expected to hear today.
It's real. The construction boom over the past few years, particularly in the central region and Jerusalem, has created demand for licensed blasters that's outpacing supply. The Ministry of Defense has run accelerated training programs to try to close the gap, but the security clearance timeline is the hard constraint. You can't speed run a background check.
If you're a contractor planning a deep excavation in Jerusalem, and you know you're going to hit rock that needs blasting, you might need to book your blaster months in advance. That's a real operational constraint.
It's not just about availability. It's about the blaster being integrated into the project planning from the beginning. The blast design affects the excavation sequence, which affects the shoring design, which affects everything else. You can't just bring in a blaster at the last minute and say, "Make this rock go away." The blast pattern has to be designed in coordination with the structural engineer, the geotechnical engineer, and the contractor.
Which brings us to what a blaster actually does, because I think the mental model for most people is exactly that. Someone shows up, drills some holes, pushes a button, collects a check. But you're describing something much more integrated.
It's an engineering role. The blaster starts by analyzing the rock. What type is it? What's the fracture pattern? What's the compressive strength? Based on that, they calculate the charge weight per hole, the hole spacing, the hole depth, and the delay timing between holes. The delay timing is critical because it determines the direction the energy propagates. You can literally steer the blast energy away from sensitive structures by sequencing the detonations correctly.
It's not just how much explosive, it's in what order and at what interval.
The interval is measured in milliseconds. Modern blasting uses electronic detonators that can be programmed to fire at precise delays, sometimes as little as a few milliseconds apart. This lets you create a smooth wall, blast where the perimeter holes fire last, shearing the rock along the intended excavation line while the interior holes have already fragmented and relieved the pressure.
That's remarkably precise. I'm imagining the difference between that and just hammering away for 8 hours, and I can see why the blast might actually be gentler on the neighbors.
There's actual vibration data on this. A mechanical hammer operating for an 8-hour shift transmits vibration continuously. It's low amplitude, but it's relentless. Over days or weeks, that cumulative vibration can cause fatigue cracking in adjacent structures, especially older masonry buildings. A controlled blast delivers higher peak vibration, but for maybe 2 or 3 seconds total. The cumulative energy transmitted to the surrounding structures is often lower. And there are vibration limits set by the Israeli standard, based on the German DIN standard, that the blaster has to stay under, measured by seismographs placed on nearby buildings.
The blaster is not just designing the blast. They're monitoring its effects in real time with instrumentation. That's a long way from push-button, rock-go-boom.
This is where the Jerusalem light rail example is so instructive. When they were excavating the tunnels near the old city, within meters of structures that are hundreds of years old, some of them thousands, they used controlled blasting with very precise delay timing and very small charges. The blast design specified exactly how much explosive per hole, exactly how many holes per round, and exactly what delay sequence would direct the energy inward toward the tunnel face rather than outward toward the buildings. And they had seismographs on the surrounding structures the whole time.
I remember walking past those sites and feeling the ground bump, just a single thump, not the continuous hammering you hear elsewhere. And now I understand why. It wasn't just that blasting was faster. It was that blasting, done right, was actually the preservation-minded choice.
Which is the paradox Daniel was pointing at. The thing that sounds more destructive is sometimes the thing that preserves what you're trying to protect.
Let's pull on the thread Daniel raised about the military-civilian overlap. We've established that civilian blasting is a distinct licensed profession with its own training pipeline, but we're in Israel. The IDF has been training combat engineers for decades. A lot of those people lead the army with serious explosives expertise. Where do they fit into this?
This is where it gets really interesting. The skills transfer directly, there's no question about that. An IDF combat engineer has extensive training in explosives handling, blast calculation, safety protocols, and practical demolition. They understand charge weights and delay timing and the behavior of different explosives in different materials. That knowledge is directly applicable to civilian blasting.
You'd think they could just walk into a civilian blasting job.
That's the misconception. They can't. A former combat engineer does not automatically receive a civilian blasting license. They still have to pass the civilian written exam, the civilian practical test, and the civilian security clearance process. The Ministry of Defense deliberately keeps these pipelines separate.
If the skills transfer, why not just grant reciprocity?
A couple of reasons. One is that the contexts are different enough that the civilian exam tests things the military training doesn't emphasize. Like the specific regulatory framework, the civilian explosives classifications, the documentation requirements for commercial blasting. Military blasting is optimized for breaching, cratering, demolition of structures, whereas civilian blasting is optimized for precision, vibration control, and minimizing collateral effects. The mindset is different.
It's the same underlying physics, but applied in opposite directions. One is about maximizing destructive effect on a target. The other is about minimizing destructive effect on everything except the target.
And the second reason is institutional. The Ministry of Defense wants a clear legal and regulatory separation between military and civilian explosives use. If a former combat engineer screws up on a construction site, the liability and the investigation fall under the civilian framework, the explosives law, the police, the civilian courts. If there were automatic reciprocity, you'd have a much murkier jurisdictional picture.
That actually makes a lot of sense. The separation isn't about distrusting the skills. It's about maintaining clear lines of accountability.
In practice, many civilian blasters in Israel are former combat engineers. It's a common career path. Finish military service, go through the civilian licensing process, and then work for a construction company or a specialized blasting subcontractor. But they still have to pass the same exams as someone coming in through a purely civilian training program.
Are there people who enter the profession without military background?
There are civilian training programs, some run by the Ministry of Defense, some by private training providers approved by the ministry. Someone with a background in civil engineering or geology can go through the training, pass the exams, get the clearance, and become a licensed blaster without ever having served in a combat engineering unit. It's less common because the military pipeline produces a lot of people who already have the aptitude and interest, but it's a real pathway.
The profession draws from both pools, but the licensing gate is the same height for everyone.
That's a feature of the system, not a bug. It means the civilian blasting profession maintains its own standards and its own culture, even while benefiting from the military's training investment.
Let me ask you something that might sound naive. When we talk about a blaster having access to commercial explosives, what are we actually talking about? What kind of materials are we dealing with in construction blasting, and how are they different from military explosives?
Not naive at all. It's a crucial distinction. Construction blasting typically uses commercial explosives like ANFO, ammonium nitrate fuel oil, or emulsion explosives, which are essentially ammonium nitrate suspended in an oil-based matrix. These are relatively insensitive. You can drop them, you can hit them with a hammer, and they won't detonate. They require a high-energy initiation system, usually a detonating cord or a booster charge, to set them off. Military explosives, by contrast, are often designed to be more sensitive and more powerful per unit weight, things like RDX or TNT or plastic explosives.
This stuff on a construction site is intentionally harder to set off accidentally.
Very much so, and that's part of the regulatory logic. Commercial explosives are classified as hazardous materials, but they're not weaponized. The explosives law draws a clear distinction between commercial explosives, used in construction and quarrying and mining, and what the law calls security materials, which covers military-grade explosives and weapons. The licensing division regulates both, but under different frameworks.
Which brings us to the second part of Daniel's question, how the hazardous materials are actually regulated day to day. And I think this is where the system gets really granular.
Let me give you the specifics on storage, because this is where the regulatory mindset becomes physical. Explosives in Israel cannot be stored just anywhere. They have to be kept in licensed magazines. And magazine, here, is a term of art, meaning a dedicated storage structure built to specific standards. Reinforced concrete construction, minimum wall thickness, lightning protection systems, double-lock steel doors with two different key holders.
Two different key holders. So no single person can access the magazine alone.
That's the principle. It's a two-person rule designed to prevent both theft and unauthorized use. The magazine also has to be a certain distance from inhabited buildings and public roads. The exact setback depends on the quantity and type of explosives stored. And the magazine is inspected regularly by the Ministry of Defense's licensing division. If the locks aren't maintained, if the lightning protection isn't tested, if the inventory doesn't match the logbook, you can lose your storage license.
What happens to the blaster who cuts corners on this?
There was a case in 2023. A civilian blaster in the north was fined and had his license suspended for storing commercial explosives in an unlicensed container on a construction site. Not a proper magazine, just a locked shipping container. He'd been doing it for weeks because the nearest licensed magazine was an hour's drive and he was trying to save time on the daily transport. The Ministry of Defense found out during a routine inspection and the penalties were not trivial.
An hour's drive to save maybe 15 minutes of paperwork. That's the kind of shortcut that seems rational until it isn't.
It illustrates how the regulatory burden shapes behavior. The transport rules alone are a whole operational constraint. Explosives have to be moved in dedicated vehicles, not the same truck that hauls rebar in the morning. The vehicle needs GPS tracking, a fire suppression system, specific hazard placarding, and the driver needs a special endorsement on their license beyond a standard commercial permit. You can't just throw a box of emulsion cartridges in the back of a pickup and drive across town.
The logistics of being a blaster include a whole parallel supply chain that a regular contractor never has to think about.
That's part of why there's a blaster shortage. It's not just the licensing bottleneck, it's that the operational overhead of compliance is high enough that some people who might be interested in the profession look at the regulatory burden and decide it's not worth it. The construction boom has created demand that the licensing pipeline can't meet, and the security clearance timeline is the hard constraint. You can't speed up a background check without compromising what the background check is supposed to catch.
Which brings us back to the structural tension. Israel has one of the deepest pools of military explosives expertise in the world per capita, And yet, there's a civilian blaster shortage. The wall between the pipelines is doing exactly what it was designed to do, but maybe doing it too well for the current construction market.
The comparison to other countries makes this tension visible. In the United States, blasters are licensed by the ATF at the federal level, plus state-level agencies with their own requirements. In Australia, blasting licenses are issued by state mining regulators. The Israeli system is unusually centralized, one ministry, one licensing division, one set of rules for the entire country. That centralization has security advantages, but it also means there's exactly one bottleneck. If the Ministry of Defense is slow on clearances, the whole country feels it.
Centralized control, centralized bottleneck.
That's the trade-off. In a country where explosive security isn't just a workplace safety issue, but a national security issue, the centralization makes sense. But it comes at a cost, and right now the cost is showing up in project timelines and contractor frustration.
You mentioned the security clearance process being the bottleneck. What's actually happening in that clearance that takes so long?
It's a comprehensive background investigation, criminal history certainly, but also financial history, associations, travel patterns, and interviews with references. The concern isn't just that the applicant might be a criminal. It's that someone with blasting credentials could become a vector for materials or knowledge to move into the wrong hands. In Israel, that concern is not theoretical, so the clearance process is thorough, and thorough takes time.
There's no fast track for former combat engineers who've already held security clearances in the military.
The military clearance and the civilian blasting clearance are separate processes, run by different authorities. Having held a military clearance helps. It demonstrates a baseline of trustworthiness, but it doesn't substitute for the civilian vetting. Again, the deliberate separation.
The system is working as designed, even if the design creates friction. That's almost refreshing, in a regulatory sense. Most systems create friction by accident.
This one creates friction on purpose. The question is whether the purpose still matches the current reality. When the explosives law was written in 1954, the concern was about armed infiltration and sabotage. Today, the primary driver of demand for blasters is apartment towers and light rail tunnels. The security environment has changed, but the regulatory architecture hasn't.
Which is a question for the future, not for us to resolve today. But it's the right question to leave hanging. If I'm a developer in Tel Aviv right now, and I've got a deep excavation coming up that's going to hit hard rock, what's my actual timeline for getting a blaster on site? Are we talking weeks or months?
The licensed blasters who are any good are booked well in advance. If you wait until the shoring is in and the rock is exposed before you start looking for a blaster, you've already made a very expensive mistake. The blast design needs to be integrated into the excavation plan from the beginning. Hole diameters affect shoring design. Vibration limits affect charge weights. The blasting sequence affects the excavation staging. You want the blaster in the room when the geotechnical engineer is still doing the site investigation.
The actionable thing is, build the relationship before you break ground. Know who your blaster is going to be during the design phase, not the construction phase.
That's not just good practice. In a tight market, it's survival. I've heard of projects in Jerusalem where the general contractor had to delay the excavation sequence by 6 weeks because the blaster they wanted wasn't available. 6 weeks of idle equipment and crew. That's a line item nobody wants to explain to the developer.
Which makes the blaster, in a weird way, one of the most powerful people on a construction project. Not the highest paid, probably not the most visible, but if they're not available, the whole thing stops.
The bottleneck isn't going away. The Ministry of Defense's accelerated training programs have helped at the margins, but the security clearance timeline is what it is. If you're a developer, you either plan around it or you pay the price.
The other thing Daniel's question made me think about is what a regular person walking past a site can actually observe. You mentioned blasting mats earlier, those heavy rubber blankets over the blast zone. Are there other tells?
The seismograph cables are a big one. If you see small gray boxes mounted on the walls of adjacent buildings with cables running down to the sidewalk, those are vibration monitors. They're usually labeled with the monitoring company's name. That's a sign that blasting is either happening or about to happen. Also, municipalities often publish blasting permits, or at least notifications of scheduled blasts online. It's public information, but almost nobody looks for it.
I had no idea municipalities published those.
They're required to give notice to nearby residents, and the easiest way to do that at scale is to post the schedule online. It's not always easy to find. Sometimes it's buried in the engineering department's permits page, but it's there. If you live near a major excavation and you want to know when they're blasting versus hammering, that's where you look.
That's useful, and it connects back to the safety paradox we've been talking about. If you know a blast is scheduled for Tuesday at 2 in the afternoon, and you feel a single thump instead of hours of hammering, you can actually appreciate what's happening. That the thing that felt more alarming was probably the gentler option for the buildings around you.
Especially relevant in a place like Israel where we're on a fault line. Buildings here already have to contend with seismic loading. Adding cumulative fatigue from months of mechanical hammering is not nothing. The structural engineering literature is pretty clear on this. Repeated low-amplitude vibration can propagate micro-cracks in masonry and concrete, especially in older buildings that weren't designed with modern seismic detailing. A controlled blast delivers the energy and then stops. The structure doesn't have to endure millions of load cycles.
If you're a resident near a construction site and you're worried about damage to your building, the question to ask isn't, are they blasting? It's, what's the cumulative vibration exposure over the life of the project? And counterintuitively, blasting might be the answer that protects your home better.
Which is exactly the kind of thing that sounds wrong until you look at the data. And that's the value of understanding what a blaster actually does. It reframes the whole question from explosives are scary to what's the engineering judgment here. Here's the thing I keep coming back to. As the construction boom continues, and there's no sign of it slowing, does the profession gradually civilianize, or does the military pipeline remain the dominant source of talent? Because right now it's roughly 70-30, but the pressures are shifting.
What's pushing it towards civilianization?
1. The work itself is becoming more technical in ways that reward a different kind of training. Electronic detonators with programmable delays, three-dimensional blast modeling software that simulates wave propagation through specific rock formations, real-time vibration monitoring that feeds back into the blast design. This is starting to look less like a trade and more like a branch of geotechnical engineering. The old image of the blaster as a rugged guy with a plunger box is about as accurate as the image of a surgeon with a bone saw.
The profession is outgrowing the cowboy stereotype from both directions. More math, more modeling, more regulatory paperwork.
That favors people coming in through civilian engineering programs rather than through combat engineering, where the training is excellent but not optimized for three-dimensional finite element analysis of blast effects. The second pressure is just volume. The construction boom needs more blasters than the military pipeline can produce, especially given the licensing bottleneck. So, you're seeing more civilian training cohorts, more people entering from geology and civil engineering backgrounds.
The military pipeline isn't going away. Israel isn't about to stop training combat engineers.
Of course not. And that's the ongoing tension. You have this deep, durable source of talent that will always exist, and a civilian profession that needs to absorb some of it while also developing its own independent recruitment pipeline. The question is whether the balance shifts from 70-30 to something more like 50-50 over the next decade.
The other thing that strikes me is that the safety record has been improving steadily, but the regulatory burden hasn't lightened. If anything, it's gotten heavier. More documentation, more monitoring, more oversight. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
It's not. Partly that's because the precision tools, electronic detonators, modeling software, real-time seismography, generate data, and data invites regulation. When all you had was a safety fuse and experience, there wasn't much to audit. Now there's a digital trail of every blast, every delay time, every vibration reading. That's good for safety and accountability, but it also means the compliance overhead keeps growing.
Which circles back to the bottleneck problem. If the profession becomes more technical and more regulated at the same time, the barrier to entry rises on two fronts.
Yet the demand keeps rising. Jerusalem alone has something like 40 major excavation projects in various stages right now. Every one of them either has a blaster on call or is hoping they won't need one. The profession isn't going to shrink. It's going to become more essential, more visible, and probably more contested as a career path.
The open question Daniel's prompt leaves us with is whether the deliberate wall between military and civilian blasting holds, or whether the market pressure eventually forces some kind of bridge, maybe a fast-track licensing pathway for combat engineers that preserves the safety standards but cuts the redundant testing.
That's the debate happening inside the Ministry of Defense right now, actually. There's a working group looking at whether the civilian exam can be modified to credit military training for the portions that overlap, while still testing the civilian-specific competencies separately. No decisions yet, but the fact that they're even looking at it tells you the pressure is real.
A working group. The most quietly powerful phrase in Israeli bureaucracy.
It's where things actually change, or don't.
For now, the blaster remains what we've described. A licensed professional operating at the intersection of geology, structural engineering, and pyrotechnics, regulated by the Ministry of Defense under a 72-year-old law, drawn mostly but not exclusively from the military, and increasingly essential to the basic function of building anything tall in this country. And the next time you feel the ground shake in a parking lot, you'll know whether to be worried or relieved.
Usually relieved if a blaster designed it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, a Russian expedition to Sakhalin Island documented a species of jellyfish that can revert from its adult Medusa stage back to its juvenile polyp stage when stressed or starved, essentially reversing its life cycle, a capability that makes it functionally immortal under the right conditions.
Decides to be young again.
I have questions I'm not sure I want answered.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. For show notes and more, visit myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.